we help clients move beyond the stuckness that's giving them a sense of safety? As Dr. Kelly McGonigal puts it, our desire to always avoid pain can put us in a cocoon. So how do we help clients break free? Kelly answers this with the missing zero strategy.
Well, I think that, you know, most people are hardwired to avoid discomfort. And to get unstuck requires basically being comfortable with discomfort, with being uncomfortable. That there's a sort of that process of breaking free from whatever is keeping you in a certain habit or a certain, you know, part of your life. And that process of breaking free often requires experiencing things like anxiety or self-doubt or physical discomfort. And I think often when we first meet that first point of discomfort, it's very easy to think it would be easier to stay the same. It would be easier to not push on. And so when I think about getting unstuck, often it's a process of finding a way to embrace the discomfort that comes about when we first start trying to, you know, get out of the cocoon or get out of the quicksand, whichever can feel very nice and cozy to be stuck, but also can feel like we're drowning sometimes in being stuck. And, you know, in some ways, I think actually when it's a cocoon that's keeping you stuck, in some ways, that's a lot harder to see than when you feel like you're drowning in quicksand and you're trying to claw your way, you know, up or to some freedom.
Right, because in the latter, when you're in this quicksand experience, the quicksand moment, you have maybe more hit bottom and you're sick and tired of whatever.
Yeah, you have a sense of what's dragging you down. And so it can become that motivation, right, can become very present, that I don't want this anymore. And I think sometimes if you haven't reached that stage yet, you know, it's very important to actually figure out what is it that you don't want any longer and what's the positive vision that's going to give you the courage to break free or pull yourself out. You know, one of my favorite strategies for getting unstuck actually comes from research on willpower, coincidentally. Some of my colleagues at Stanford several years ago, they were looking at how to increase people's self-control when they were making decisions. And they realized that when most people are thinking, for example, do I want the cookie or do I not want the cookie? Do I want to buy this now or do I want to not buy it now? They are comparing the sort of the immediate temptation to not having that temptation. What they found was that people needed to find what researchers call the missing zero, that there's actually something you're giving up if you say yes to this. You know, if you say yes to the cookie, you might be giving up the benefits to your own energy and well-being that you would feel if you made a healthier choice. You're actually giving that up. That's the missing zero. It's the thing you lose when you say yes to the cookie. Or if you buy something that you can't really afford, you know, it's not just, do I have the sweater or do I not have the sweater? It's, do I have the sweater or do I choose not having the sweater? Because what I'm choosing is how amazing it's going to feel when I get out of debt, you know, the ability to save for retirement. I'm actually choosing something else when I choose to give up this immediate gratification. And so I started to think about applying that technique of trying to find what the missing zero is in the opposite direction. So what are you losing out on when you refuse to do something that would really help you change or, you know, pursue a goal that's important to you? So for example, I might ask people, you know, is there anything in your life that you would like to do or pursue or change, but that you're not doing it because of how stressful or difficult it feels? There's something that you're putting off because you just don't want to face how it feels when you think about having to actually get it done. And people can often identify something like that. And then so the next question is, what's the missing zero? What are the costs to choosing not to take that next step? What are the costs of choosing to stay the same? What are you missing out on? And would it enrich your life in any way if you were able to make that choice? And that sort of self-reflection, like literally recognizing what are the costs of staying the same? What are the costs of saying no to an opportunity because you aren't 100% sure whether you'll succeed or you aren't 100% sure whether you can handle it? What are the costs of saying no to that? What are you losing? Are there any opportunities that you have not said yes to in the past? And what were the costs of that?
Sometimes people don't know, though.
Yes.
Like, you know, you go through a door and it often opens other doors. But from behind the first door, you don't really know what it might open.
In my experience, you don't always know what it will open, but there's another cost to not allowing yourself to take a step in the direction of something that you want for yourself. So it's not necessarily the outcome, right? So the way you're describing it, I would think, you know, you'd be asking people to predict what are the benefits of taking this step.
All right, taking this opportunity that I might fail at.
But you know what the actual costs are? It's not just losing out on, you know, being a success in your career or finding a new relationship or so whatever takes that courage. People can actually feel the cost of avoidance immediately, because when you avoid something because you want to avoid the discomfort or the self-doubt, what you actually experience is self-disappointment, loneliness, a sense of stagnation. That actually, it's sort of a paradox, but whatever it is that we're trying to resist or avoid, by making that the motivation or the reason behind not changing or not taking action, we actually end up strengthening the experience we wanted to avoid. And so most people, if you ask them, like let's say that they are not pursuing relationships because they don't want to get hurt. And you ask, well, are there any costs to you right now of not pursuing relationships and of being alone? What are you actually choosing by choosing that? You know, people often are having the very kind of experience that they're trying to defend or protect themselves against, like loneliness or feeling unloved. So the very thing that they were trying to defend against. You know, the same is true if you're stuck because of anxiety and you're choosing not to do something because you want to avoid the experience of fear if you actually were to put yourself in that situation and take that first step. And usually people are able to recognize that the cost of trying to avoid fear is often actually a strengthened sense of fear, of inadequacy, of lacking courage. And the costs of not doing it are actually very similar to the cost of doing it, except you also now don't have any of the benefits or any of the transformative experiences that come when we choose to put ourselves in situations that require us to grow or that create connections and relationships and opportunities. So even if we don't know exactly what they are, we can imagine that there might be some benefits. And we also can be very aware of what the consequences are to us now of not taking that first step.
Kelly had an interesting take on helping clients push past their boundaries. I wanted her to talk more about how to get clients to buy into the idea of discomfort. Here are some further thoughts from Kelly, and then we're going to go into two other perspectives from Dr. Ron Siegel and Bill O'Hanlon.
One of the reasons that avoiding discomfort becomes a cycle is because we are so afraid of feeling the discomfort that we don't actually notice that we're capable of tolerating it. I mean, it's almost like people don't trust themselves. And so the strategy of mindfulness and acceptance says, well, look, we're going to get uncomfortable for a moment. You know, we're going to put a cigarette on the table and you're not going to smoke it and you're going to feel what the cravings are like. Or maybe you'll touch base with a painful memory and see what that's like rather than immediately trying to push it out of your mind and see what arises in your body and also sense that you have some freedom in this moment. Right? So that's really important, the bringing the mindfulness and the acceptance. But, you know, when I was thinking about how to go even further with this idea of learning how to tolerate discomfort, I remembered a study, and actually it took me a long time to find it because I hadn't seen it in a while. But this was a study that was done at Missouri State University that was a test of pain tolerance. And they compared people's ability to tolerate pain simply on mindfulness and acceptance, that it's uncomfortable, but you can handle it, notice what it feels like, sort of the way that I would normally teach distress tolerance. They compared that to another group that was also encouraged to imagine that the pain they were feeling was in service of a value that they care about. So for example, if they had said what they really care about is their family, they were asked to imagine that they were enduring this pain because they were in icy water and they were about to rescue a family member that they loved. Of course, it's a visualization. But what they found is that people who were accepting and mindful and had that added value had significantly more pain tolerance than people who were just trying to accept and mindfully attend to the distress. And I feel like this is a big missing piece for a lot of people in the ability to tolerate distress, is you have to view the distress as in service of something you care about. And that's why it is so important to know what the big why is behind any sort of change that's going to involve dealing with discomfort. and to learn to, in moments of discomfort, to bring that to mind as a resource.
Yeah, I think that that's enormously important. And to have a cognitive framework as to why it might actually make sense to do this is vital, because it reminds me of what happens in doing child therapy, where the therapist is suggesting to the child, well, let's talk about what happened with the bully, and the kid saying, that was painful. Why on earth would you possibly want to talk about that? I want to play Uno instead. And these kinds of tensions arise all the time because the child doesn't have a cognitive map for why it might make sense to do that. You know, I was thinking of another aspect of this, and this is closer to the a more traditional mindfulness-oriented approach to it. And I realized that in my clinical work, I spend a lot of time trying to help people to experience their distress as moment-to-moment bodily sensations. In fact, just before this, I was with a patient of mine who had had a significant uptick of anxiety, and it was really freaking him out to be this anxious. And he was starting to scramble around medication and the like. And I started, talking to him about, so just what does it feel like to be anxious in this way? And he immediately told me about a flood of thoughts about all the different ways in which he was afraid it was never going to stop and he wasn't going to be able to function, all this kind of stuff. And it really took quite a bit of work to move from that to, well, sweaty palms, beating heart, this kind of thing. So the value of helping people to actually experience their distress as moment-to-moment bodily sensations, which all distress, all emotional distress as well as physical distress, is a series of moment-to-moment bodily sensations, is another aspect of this, which I think can really hold people. But as Kelly was pointing out, I think so importantly, they need to have a framework for why that might make sense to do.
Yeah. I like what she said about if you're just going to give something up, like an old habit or an old belief or whatever, it's a lot harder to do. But if you're going towards something, I like this. And this is something I've really developed in my clinical work, and I was influenced again by Milton Erickson, because he was kind of a psychotically optimistic guy, and he was always imagining better futures for his clients. And I do the same thing. And so I just discovered that's reflected in my language. I say, when you come out of this depression, when you, when the anxiety, drops down and decreases. So I'm talking about a future as if it's already here. And so I use language in that way. I use before you come out of this depression. Well, that assumes you're going to come out of it. After you come out of this depression. Well, that assumes you're going to come out of it. When you come out of this depression. That assumes you're going to come out of it. So I think your language reflects, if instead my language said, when you have your next breakdown, that would be assuming a negative future. So I'm always thinking of the positive future and letting my language sort of lead me and lead the client into that. And I call this positive expectancy language. And so, sometimes it's called presupposition. You presuppose that the change is going to happen. And that's the easiest technique, that I think we just train ourselves to speak in that presupposition of what the future we hope and our clients hope and would hope if they had hope. Sometimes we have the hope at first and they don't. How can we speak and kind of pull them? Sometimes at the end of one of these sessions, one of my clients who's really depressed or, very discouraged or very stuck looks at me and says, nothing has changed, but I feel more hope. And I think that may be one of the components of that language kind of pulling both of us into that positive vision of the future. I think of a particular client I had, I was doing couples work, and but she came in on her own. And she was like, should I stay in this relationship? Really, I can't decide. I should stay, I should go. And she'd been stuck for a long time. Finally, she came in alone, and she said, I just can't figure this out. Should I stay or should I go? And I said, okay, well, let's do a little thought experiment. It's 6 months from now, and you're still in this relationship. She said, yeah, okay, I could handle that. I said, it's a year from now, and she started to look a little more uncomfortable. When we got out to 5 years, she's like, I would want to kill myself. I couldn't do it. And we just projected the same situation into the future. And she might have said, yeah, I can live with this, and it'd be better than the guilt of leaving and all the chaos that would happen. But as soon as we got out to about a year, she started thinking, I can't do that. I don't want my life to be that. And so I project people, hey, okay, if you left, What would, if you stayed the same, if you were still depressed in a year, if you were still depressed in 5 years, if you were still crippled with anxiety in 5 years, what, oh no, I have to change. And so it's really that kind of, again, upping the discomfort to create more motivation. So they say, oh yeah, okay, I can handle it now, maybe for the next while, but not for that long. I need to change. And if I'm going to change eventually, why not change now? So that's one method that just I stumbled on because I thought, I don't know what's right for her. I don't know whether she should stay or go. I can see an argument both ways. And when I projected it out, she knew much better than I could have guessed. I wouldn't have been able to guess which direction she went. But as soon as we got into the future with the same old stuff, she was highly motivated to change.
I appreciated Ron's focus on the big why for introducing discomfort, as well as Bill's thoughts on using positive expectancy language. We've heard several perspectives on the limiting fears that can hold our clients back, and how new positive experiences can spark change. In the next module, we'll get into how to use these experiences to rewire the rigid mind. I'll see you there.